How well does democracy work? Dear Lily, you will often have been told that you live in a democracy and that this is wonderful, something that should be exported all over the world. But what does democracy mean and how does it work? There are in fact two meanings. One is what I shall call democracy with a capital D. This is defined by the shorter Oxford English Dictionary as government by the people, that form of government in which the sovereign power resides in the people. It means that one person has one vote, with everyone over a certain age having such a vote. In practice, it should mean that there is a choice. One-party democracy is something of a contradiction in terms. The second is democracy with a small d. This is defined by the same dictionary as a social state in which all have equal rights. The Oxford Reference Dictionary suggests an egalitarian and tolerant form of society. So this democracy implies a feeling of freedom, equality before the law, and equality of opportunities. The system of democracy with a large D, or the sovereignty of the people, is opposed to autocracy, rule by one, which has many forms. These include oligarchy, rule by the few, plutocracy, rule by the very rich, and monarchy, rule by a single hereditary ruler or king. Democracy itself can take several forms, including republicanism, as in the United States or France, or limited monarchy, as in Britain. Was democracy expected? Since democracy is now the aspiration of many and the most popular form of government on earth, you may think that it has had a long and successful history. Not at all. 100 years ago, no one lived in a democracy in the strict sense of the word. In the middle of the 20th century, the few existing democracies were nearly wiped out by fascism, the ideology of state power, and communism, the ideology of abolition of the state and private property. Until 1980, democracy was still a minority form of government. The majority of governments and the majority of people lived in autocracies. Only with the fall of the Soviet Union in 1989 did democracies outnumber autocracies. So why have many countries gravitated towards these forms? The difficult thing in politics is to tread a middle path. Usually, at certain points in the history of civilizations, there is too much chaos and factionalism. We find the disintegration of the state over much of Europe after the fall of Rome, in China after the Opium Wars, or in Eastern Europe after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Local chiefs, lords, commissars, and warlords increase in power and bandits roam. the state is dismembered and cannot maintain a monopoly of the use of force. This is deeply unpleasant for most of the inhabitants, trampled over and pulled this way and that. If wealth and technical efficiency increase, and temporary alliances turn into permanent ones, everything changes. Political power increases at the state level and local resistance is crushed. Often this coincides with the banning of all alternative groupings. So a movement from disintegration to over-integration, or at least attempted total control, is the normal pattern. Very rarely does an alternative appear. In small city-states, or in the early history of empires, this alternative is often called republicanism. Citizens, that is, the free members of a republic, whether in Athens, early Rome, the Florentine Republic of the 15th century, or the Dutch Republic of the 17th century, although usually a minority of the population, share in government. There's no single ruler, no king or dictator. Yet this is an unstable arrangement, which soon drifts towards some form of monarchy. For instance, it took only a few years for the Commonwealth under Oliver Cromwell in England to drift back to the unpopular idea that Cromwell's successor should be his son. It took little time for Napoleon to set himself up as ruler and establish a new dynasty after the French Revolution had established a republic in France in 1789. Power is soon concentrated in the hands of a single ruler, his family, and close circle. Republics not only are short-lived, but are usually found only in small political units. Until the later 18th century, there is no case of a large state the size of France, Spain, Japan, or China being a republic for more than a few years. In the 20th century, new forms of autocracy took power away from traditional rulers in Russia and China, or from the people, Germany, Italy, Spain, and placed it in the hands of the Communist Party or the fascist state. The present swing to democracy is strange and unprecedented. Why is democracy so fashionable? Some say that democracy has temporarily triumphed because it is economically successful. Democracy is part of a package which ensures that individuals can pursue their economic goals in safety, and indeed are encouraged to do so. So it tends to generate economic and hence military success. Yet there are difficulties with this argument. It's clear that democracy does not automatically generate economic growth. It's possible to point to periods in the history of democratic societies, including the recession in the United States in the 1930s, when there has been economic decline. Secondly, there are forms of autocracy, as in China today with its amazing economic growth, that are temporarily more successful than most democracies. There are one-party bureaucratic states such as Singapore, or some would argue Japan, that have had extraordinary growth without democracy in the normal sense of the word. So neither is democracy a guarantee of growth, nor is it the only path. Others suggest that democracy is successful because it wins the affections of people who feel empowered by their right to choose their leaders. They treasure the feelings of liberty when they can, through such choice, run their own lives. There's clearly something in this. Yet the speed with which people have abandoned democracy when it failed economically, as the rise of Hitler and Mussolini shows, makes us pause. The fact that most people in Britain now do not bother to vote in local and European elections, and that the number voting in national elections in the United States is shrinking so dramatically, suggests that the emotional appeal is less strong than might be assumed. Does democracy satisfy? There are good reasons why people fail to vote. In ancient Athens, democracy, while proclaimed, was largely incomplete. Only a very small part of the people, that is, the free male citizens, had any say in government. Full suffrage in Britain took a long time to achieve. It was not until 1928 that women got the right to vote in parliamentary elections. There are other dangers. One is known as the tyranny of the majority. According to the logic of democracy, the government should obey the will of the majority. The majority may well be fickle and have illiberal views. It may be swayed by newspapers or orators to be intolerant, bigoted, or even, as in Maoist China or Hitler's Germany, fairly unpleasant. Minorities can suffer badly from the majority view. This has been found historically by the Jews. In many parts of the world, asylum seekers, homosexuals, and gypsies have also suffered from the intolerance of the majority. An equal danger lies in politicians doing what they feel is best for the country, even if most of the people who elected them did not vote for their specific actions and may not agree with them. Another difficulty resides in reducing the complexity of life to a single decision between opposing political parties. At national elections, the parties put forward their ideas in a manifesto. Many people agree with bits from each of the opposing party programs, but you can only vote for one side. When they come to power, the politicians may refer to their manifesto, which most have not read, and then pursue policies that those who elected them did not anticipate. People consequently feel cheated, and there are allegations of elective dictatorship. Furthermore, the party in power often brings in new ideas after a year or two with which people who voted for them totally disagree. They fight a war, or bring in new taxes, or criminal legislation that are unacceptable even to their strongest supporters. People can write to their Member of Parliament, but they feel that this has little effect. As the British Labour Prime Minister Clement Attlee candidly admitted, democracy means government by discussion, but it is only effective if you can stop people talking. What is the strength of democracy? Many people think that the only real virtue of the system is that the politicians are accountable at the end of a limited term in power through the need for re-election. This tempers the arrogance of power. The fact that there is an almost automatic swing against whoever is in power, since they soon appear to be the source of our present discontent, means that the government is periodically purged. After a while in office, every government appears shabby. This may save a country from the drift to autocracy. The fact that almost all our leaders, once they are in power, appear to us as fools, pathetically inadequate, or seriously deceived, shows that the system is working. On a recent visit to China, I met many young people who had recently discovered that their leaders appeared to be old, stupid, and corrupt. These young Chinese were cynical, and yet upset by this realization. I assured them that this very cynicism is rampant over the last 300 years or more in England, that it is one of the glories of democracy. Those in power should never be trusted fully. We should always remember the novelist Daniel Defoe's short verse, "Nature has left this tincture in the blood, that all men would be tyrants if they could." The British Prime Minister Winston Churchill observed, "It has been said that democracy is the worst form of government, except all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. It's often a sham, a mask for power, but it is difficult to think of a better system." Should our rights and freedoms be enshrined in writing? People have suggested that we would be better protected against our rulers and the tyranny of the majority through a written constitution. Certainly, the American Constitution was a noble document, guaranteeing individual liberties and freedom of conscience. But it has worked because the principles it enshrined were very vague and general truisms, a statement of the obvious ideas transferred from the unwritten British political system. It could be, and has been, interpreted in entirely different ways by different people. Written constitutions in themselves are no guarantee of liberty. The French, Italians, and Germans have had many written constitutions over the last 200 years, but these have not protected them against tyranny. Attempts to introduce a European constitution are causing considerable alarm, since there is a feeling that it is too open-ended, too easily amendable, too undermining of subsidiary powers, hazy about the level of responsibilities. The new order will soon be overburdened by trying to specify too much. By its silences and omissions, it may destroy rather than increase liberty. So what is liberty? There are two types of liberty, negative and positive. Negative liberty is the core of the English tradition. There are certain things that others, including the state, cannot do to you. They cannot seize your body or your wealth without due process of law. They cannot take away your freedom of speech, action, or right of association with others without legal warrant. A few negative rules cover most of life. They are encapsulated by the philosopher John Stuart Mill when he wrote, "The liberty of the individual must be thus far limited. He must not make himself a nuisance to other people." Positive liberty, on the other hand, is the right and often the duty to do certain things. The right to health care, the right to be employed, the right to schooling. This sounds fine, but the problem is that much more has to be itemized. Anything not specified explicitly can be assumed to be absent as a right. Positive liberty is the essence of the past continental European tradition. It tends to end up in overblown bureaucracy and much extra work for lawyers. With well-meaning attention to minute details, it can stifle true democracy, and even democracy with a capital D. Many have felt that laws and politicians should not tell you how you should behave. That is the province of religion. Fascism and communism are an attempt to bend the will of the people towards what the leaders think is the moral way. They combine the roles of religion and politics. And many feel that the law and politicians should stick to stating what you must not do. Does freedom from interference help? One advantage of the negative definition of liberty is that it gives greater flexibility in a multicultural world. If we examine games, we find that their openness comes from the fact that rules are negative, not positive. In football, there is just a minimal set of negative rules. You must not pick up the ball unless you're the goalkeeper, trip up other people, get offside, and so on. There are no positive rules telling you that you must be nice to everyone, you must smile at people, you must always show courtesy, always shake hands with your opponents at any opportunity. One of the greatest achievements of the United States has been the way in which, over the centuries, it has absorbed waves of immigrants. Although we no longer believe it is a true melting pot, certainly many groups with different origins live moderately amicably together. They can be Americans, because to be so does not demand their hearts and souls. There are things you cannot do to your fellow countrymen, at least as an American. Kill people, steal their property, forbid them from saying things. But there are very positive things you have to do or to believe. Even saluting the flag and eating apple pie and Thanksgiving turkey are optional. Likewise, in the British Empire, there were negative rules of a universal kind, but with some exceptions, such as the banning of widow burning and headhunting, individual consciences and variations in belief and culture were not to be interfered with. This was different from the Catholic continental European tradition. This may be one of the reasons why many British look with such apprehension at the attempts to introduce positive laws and positive discrimination, positive human rights, a new political and legal order by way of the European Parliament and Constitution. What are the deeper roots of democracy? The British unease about the European Constitution can be understood only if we look at 1,000 years of history. The English view is that modern democracy was nurtured and grown in England in its early form, and only later exported. They argue that the social and mental underpinning of democracy, that is, democracy in the wider sense of responsibility and power passed down to lower levels, is a very local and old affair. These historians examine the workings of the unwritten English Constitution. They note the balance and separation of powers, delegation of responsibility, and a set of intermediary institutions, that is, things like the universities, companies, religious organizations, clubs and associations, which lie between the subject and the state. According to the dominant ideas of the last 1,000 years, the ruler was not absolute, but first among equals. There may be many loyalties or obligations. Only some of them are to the state. England was, in some respect, the most integrated and powerful state in history. Taxes were high. There were few overmighty subjects. There were few banned institutions. Every subject was bound into the political system. Although for a very long time only a few of the richer landlords had a vote, so the majority of the population, and particularly women, were disenfranchised, many people had a say in part of the running of their own lives. So there was relatively effective government, combined with a good deal of delegated power. It was not full democracy in the modern sense, but it was a particularly open, liberal, and tolerant society, and there was a good deal of equality before the law, with the partial exception of lords, peers, making it an unusually egalitarian one. A democracy with a small d of a sort. Is democracy the solution to the world's woes? People living in parts of New Guinea noticed that when the white people arrived, they often built airfields. Planes would then arrive to spill out huge quantities of desirable things or cargo. It seemed clear that the airfields were the key. They attracted the planes. So the people hopefully built airfields and then waited for the cargo to arrive. They were disappointed. We have become the same with democracy. We have observed that democracy is often associated with consumer success and some forms of freedom. Democracies, we feel, deliver the goods. We conclude that if we set out and build democracies around the world by persuasion, bribes, or force, the benefits linked to democracy will automatically follow. If we put out the ballot boxes, the rest will soon occur. We will be equally disappointed. We have forgotten that democracy is the result of many things. It is as much the consequence as the cause of things we appreciate. We have become political cargo cultists. Can democracy last? It may well be that economic growth is necessary for the success of democracy. The Soviet Union collapsed largely because of its poor economic performance. Democracy has won because it delivers wealth. Yet democracy, as we have seen, does not guarantee growth. Other systems may be more efficient, not just in the short term, as in many of the new nations in Asia, but perhaps in the long term as well, as in China. Nor does democracy guarantee equality. It may well be that equality before the law and the rule of law are necessary for democracy. But democracy and such equality do not guarantee any specific outcome in terms of actual equality. The increasingly pronounced extremes of wealth and poverty in the United States contrast starkly with the extraordinary economic equality in the largely one-party Japan. This suggests that while individuals may be politically free in a place with democracy, they may be materially unfree, the poor being worse housed, worse educated, and less healthy than the rich. History has not come to an end, as some prematurely alleged. The triumphs of democratic capitalism, the triumph is not assured forever. Only vigilance, combined with luck, will ensure that the least bad of all political systems lasts for another 100 years in those parts of the world that desire it. Humility is the best way to ensure that it spreads to other countries which have as yet not enjoyed its blessings and its frustrations. Active participation by the people, combined with deep skepticism, may keep the system alive.